You are naturally quick-witted. You can mock and jest better than others. You know playthings and silly, worn-out games. You are no less schooled in the frivolous side of general education than in its serious side. And you possess, besides, a glib tongue that is not without its charm. If you further mix into your jibes a touch of malice, so as to stir not only laughter but bitterness through your ill-natured wit, you will have wholly and skillfully captured a master who is by nature disposed to listen eagerly to accusations delivered under cover of mockery. For his ears, as you know, are wide open and pricked up toward those who have made a practice of weaving slander together with false accusation. And do not go looking for further material. You have the slanders against the Jews and Jewish customs, which you were taught from your very swaddling clothes, not from one man alone, but from the most scurrilous element of the city of Alexandria. Put your lessons on display. Lifted up and emboldened by these irrational and accursed devices, he kept close to Gaius and attended him constantly, absent neither by night nor by day, but present everywhere, so that he might make use of the emperor's solitary and restful hours to bring charges against the nation. This most cunning of men stirring pleasure through his jibes, so that the slanders might wound all the more. For the accuser who speaks openly, he neither admitted to being nor was able to be, but by proceeding obliquely, and by his artful contrivance, he was a harsher and heavier enemy than those who openly declared their hostility. It is said, too, that the envoys of the Alexandrians, well aware of this, had secretly hired him for great fees, not only in money but also in the hopes of honors, which they had planted in him, promising to provide them before long, once Gaius should arrive in Alexandria. And he, dreaming of that occasion when, with his master present, and with him virtually the whole inhabited world. For it was no secret that the most distinguished and eminent people from the cities, gathered from their very ends, would come together in Gaius's train to pay court. He would be honored by the greatest and most illustrious city, promised everything. Up to a certain point, then, not knowing of the enemy lurking within, we guarded only against those outside. But once we perceived him, we searched about, looking in every direction, to see whether by any means, in any manner or place, we might soften and tame the man who was shooting at us so accurately from every side. For he would play ball with Gaius and exercise with him and bathe with him and dine with him, and he was present when Gaius was about to go to sleep, holding the position, granted to no one else, of bedtime attendant and chief bodyguard within the household, so that he alone had access to the emperor's leisure hours, free from outside disturbances, to whisper into ears at rest whatever he most desired him to hear. Mockery was mixed in with the accusations, so that it would stir pleasure in some while doing us the greatest harm. For what seemed to be his principal business, the mockery was really a mere byproduct for him, while what appeared to be the byproduct, the accusations, was his only and primary business. Shaking out every rope, like men with a favorable wind at the helm, he ran on with sails full, driven by a fair breeze, piling up charge upon charge and stringing them together. And his mind was being stamped ever more firmly, so that the memory of these accusations became unforgettable. Being at a loss and without resource, since though we moved every stone to win Helicon's favor, we could find no way through, no one daring either to speak to him or approach him, because of the arrogance and harshness with which he treated everyone, and also because we did not know whether he harbored any hostility toward the Jewish race. Given that he was constantly anointing his master and inciting him against our nation, we let that avenue rest for the time being and turned instead to the more urgent matter. It seemed best to hand Gaius a memorandum containing a summary account of what we had suffered and of what we thought it right to obtain. This was, in effect, an abridgment of a longer petition we had sent a little earlier through King Agrippa, for he happened to be visiting the city, about to set out for Syria to take up the kingdom that had been given him. But it seems we were still deceiving ourselves without realizing it, just as we had before, when we first set sail thinking we would come before a judge and obtain justice. In fact, he was an implacable enemy, luring us on with what looked like a cheerful expression and rather genial greetings. For when he first greeted us kindly in the field near the Tiber, he happened to be coming out of his mother's gardens. He returned our greeting and waved his right hand, hinting at goodwill, and sent to us the man in charge of embassies, named Homilus, saying, "I myself will hear your case when I find a suitable moment." And so everyone standing round was delighted, as though we had already won, including those of our own number who are taken in by superficial appearances. I, however, thought I had rather more understanding, both because of my age and my other education, and so I was more cautious about the very thing that delighted the others. "Why?" I kept asking, turning the thought over in my own mind. "When there are so many envoys who have come from nearly every land, did he say he would hear only us? What did he mean by it? He was surely not unaware that we were Jews, for whom it is enough simply not to be treated worse than others. So is it not close to madness to suppose we were being granted a special privilege by a master who belonged to another nation, was young, and answered to no one? No, it seems rather that he had already sided with the party of the other Alexandrians, and it was to grant them a privilege that he promised to judge the case so quickly, unless, going beyond being an impartial and common listener, he becomes their ally instead of a judge, and our opponent. Turning these thoughts over, I was in turmoil and had no rest, by day or by night. And while I was despondent, bearing my distress in silence, for it was not even safe to give it voice, another calamity struck, suddenly and unexpectedly, the heaviest of all, bringing danger not to one part of the Jewish people, but, taken together, to the whole nation. We had traveled from Rome to Dikaiochia, following Gaius, for he had gone down to the coast and was spending his time around the bay, moving from one to another of his many lavishly appointed country houses. While we were preoccupied with our case, for we kept expecting to be summoned at any moment, someone approached us with a bloodshot, agitated look and gasping for breath, and drawing us a little apart from the others, for some people were standing nearby, he said, "Have you heard the news?" And just as he was about to tell us, he was checked, overcome by a sudden flood of tears. He began again, and was checked a second time, and a third. Seeing this, we were alarmed and urged him to disclose the matter he claimed to have come to tell us. "You have not come," we said, "merely to weep before witnesses, and if the matter deserves tears, do not keep the grief to yourself alone, we are by now well accustomed to misfortune." With difficulty, sobbing, but at last, in a broken voice, he said, "Our temple is lost. Gaius has ordered a colossal statue to be set up in the innermost sanctuary, bearing his own name under the title of Zeus." We were struck with astonishment at what he said. Frozen by shock and unable even to move forward, we stood speechless, our strength failing, our bodies collapsing beneath us, all bodily vigor drained away when others arrived, bringing the same agonizing news. Then, shutting ourselves away altogether, we lamented our private misfortunes and our common fate at once, and said whatever our minds suggested for a person in misfortune is most talkative struggling to keep from being abandoned altogether to lawlessness beyond remedy. We had sailed across in the dead of winter without realizing how much worse a storm was waiting for us on land than any at sea. For that storm has nature as its cause, which marks out the yearly seasons, and nature brings safety. But the author of this one is a man with nothing human in his thinking, young and bent on revolution, invested with an authority answerable to no one over everything, and youth combined with absolute power, indulging unchecked impulses, is an evil hard to fight. Will it even be possible to approach him, or to open our mouths about our houses of prayer, before the man who is ravaging the holiest of all shrines? It is obvious that he who insults the most renowned and illustrious temple, toward which east and west alike turn their gaze, shining out everywhere as the sun does, will spare no thought for the less conspicuous places held in lesser honor. And even if some safe opportunity for access should arise, what should we expect except inescapable death? But so be it, we shall die. For a most glorious death suffered in defense of the laws is itself a kind of life. But if our death will bring no benefit at all, is it not madness to perish uselessly, especially when we are supposed to be acting as envoys, so that the disaster would fall more on those who sent us than on those who endure it? What is more, even those of our own people whose natures are most opposed to wrongdoing will accuse us of impiety, for remembering, out of self-love, some private concern of our own, while the whole community is being shaken by the utmost danger. For it is necessary to set aside small things for the sake of great ones, and private concerns for the sake of the common good, and if these are lost, the whole community perishes with them. For where would it be holy or right to contend instead for anything else to show that we are Alexandrians, when it is the far more universal community of the Jews as a whole that hangs in danger. For along with the destruction of the temple comes the fear that this man, bent on revolution and grand schemes, may also order the common name of our nation to vanish along with it. Since then, both matters for which we had been sent were now lost causes, perhaps someone will say, why then did they not see to arranging a safe return? To such a person I would reply, either you do not have the genuine feeling of a noble man, or you were not brought up in, nor trained in, the sacred writings. Those who are truly noble are full of hope, and the laws produce good hope in those who encounter them, not merely with the tips of their lips. Perhaps this is a trial for the present generation, to test how it stands toward virtue, and whether it has been trained to bear terrible things with firm and resolute reasoning, without collapsing beforehand. So then, let everything that comes from human beings perish, and let it go on perishing. But let the hope in God the Savior remain unshaken in our souls, He who has often rescued the nation from situations beyond resource and beyond hope. We said all this, both mourning our unexpected misfortunes and at the same time comforting ourselves with the hope of a calmer change. Then, pausing a little, we said to those who had brought the news, why are you sitting there quietly, throwing only sparks into our ears, by which we are being scorched and set ablaze, when you ought also to be explaining what moved Gaius to this? They said, you know the highest and first cause, which indeed all people know. He wants to be regarded as a god, and he has assumed that only the Jews will not be persuaded of it, and he could inflict no greater harm on them than by defiling the sanctity of their temple. He has also been informed that it is the most beautiful of all shrines everywhere, adorned continually from ancient times at unceasing and lavish expense, and being quarrelsome and contentious by nature, he intends to appropriate it for himself. And this has now been confirmed more than before by a letter sent by Capito. Capito is the tax collector for the province of Judea, and he bears a certain grudge against the local inhabitants, for he arrived poor, and by embezzlement and skimming has amassed a considerable and varied fortune. And then, becoming anxious that some accusation might be brought against him, he devised a scheme by which he could deflect the charges of those he had wronged through slander. A certain coincidence gave him the opening he wanted for this purpose. Jamnia, a city of Judea, one of the most densely populated, is inhabited by a mixed population. Most are natives, but some are foreigners who have infiltrated from the neighboring districts. These, though in a sense resident aliens among the true natives, cause trouble and mischief, constantly undermining something of the ancestral customs of the Jews. These people, hearing from those who frequently visited how much zeal Gaius employed regarding his own deification, and how utterly estranged he was from the whole Jewish nation, thought a suitable opportunity for attack had fallen their way, and hastily set up an altar of the most makeshift material, shaping clay into bricks, for no other purpose than to plot against those living alongside them. For they knew the Jews would not tolerate it once their customs were overturned, which is exactly what happened. For when the Jews saw it and were indignant that something truly sacred in the Holy Land was being defaced, they gathered together and tore it down. The others went straight to Capito, who was the deviser of the whole drama. Thinking he had found a windfall he had been seeking for a long time, he wrote to Gaius, exaggerating and inflating the matter. Gaius, reading it through, ordered something richer and more grandiose than the brick altar set up at Jamnia out of spite, a colossal gilded statue to be installed in the sanctuary of the mother city, taking as his advisors the best and wisest of men. Helicon, a well-born slave, a gossip-monger, a piece of refuse, and a certain Apelles, a tragic actor, who in the prime of his youth, so they say, peddled his beauty, and once past his prime came onto the stage. Are those who tread the boards, trading themselves to spectators and theaters, lovers of modesty and self-control, and not of the utmost shamelessness and disorder. For this reason Apelles was admitted to the rank of advisor, so that Gaius might deliberate with one about whom to mock, with the other about what to sing, bypassing all consideration of the whole world, of whether everything everywhere was at peace and quiet. So Helicon, that scorpion-like slave, let loose Egyptian venom against the Jews, and Apelles the venom of Ascalon, for he was from there. and the people of Ascalon harbor an implacable and irreconcilable hostility toward the Jewish inhabitants of the Holy Land, since they are their neighbors. Hearing these things, we were wounded in our souls at every word and name. But the fine advisers of these fine deeds soon found the wages of their impiety. The one was bound in iron by Gaius on other charges, racked and broken on the wheel in rotation, as in cyclical diseases. The other, Helicon, was put to death by Claudius Germanicus Caesar for other wrongs that the madman had committed. But this happened later. The letter concerning the dedication of the statue was written, and not carelessly, but as circumspectly as possible for security. For he ordered Petronius, the governor of all Syria, to whom he had also written the letter, to take half of the army stationed by the Euphrates, which guarded against the crossing of the eastern kings and nations, and lead it into Judea to escort the statue, not to lend solemnity to the dedication, but so that, if anyone tried to prevent it, he would be destroyed at once. What are you saying, master? Having foreseen that they would not tolerate it, but would defend the law and die before abandoning their ancestral customs, you make war. You do not seem to be ignorant of what was likely to result from touching off revolution over the temple. Rather, having learned in advance exactly what was to come, as though it were already present, and what was to happen, as though it were already in hand, you ordered the army brought in, so that the dedication might first be consecrated by accursed sacrifices, the slaughter of wretched men and women together. Petronius, reading through what had been commanded, was at a loss, unable either to oppose it out of fear. For he knew the punishment would be unbearable, not only for those who did not carry out what was ordered, but even for those who did not do so at once, nor to undertake it easily. For he knew that instead of a single death, countless people, if it were possible, would be willing to endure it rather than allow anything forbidden to be done. For all people are protective of their own customs, but the Jewish nation especially so. For holding that the laws are oracles given by God, and having been trained in this teaching from earliest youth, they carry the images of its ordinances enshrined like statues within their souls. Then, always beholding clear impressions and forms of them in their reasoning, they are struck with awe. And those foreigners who hold these things in honor they welcome no less than their own citizens, while those who either destroy or mock them they hate as the worst enemies. They shudder at each of the things prescribed in this way, so that they would never exchange it, for the sake of transgression, for any success or happiness whatsoever among human beings, however great. Beyond all this, they have an extraordinary and exceptional zeal for the temple. The greatest proof of it, death without appeal has been decreed against members of other nations who pass beyond the inner enclosures, for they admit into the outer courts all people from everywhere. With his eyes on all this, Petronius was slow to act, considering what a monstrous deed was being carried out, and calling together, as though in council, all the reasonings of his soul, he examined the judgment of each, and found them all in agreement that nothing of what had been consecrated from the beginning should be disturbed. First, because of what is by nature just and pious, and then because of the danger hanging over him, not only from God, but also from those who would be wronged. The thought also came to him of how great this nation is in population, which has not been confined, as each of the other nations has, to the single territory allotted to it alone, but occupies, one might almost say, the whole inhabited world. For it is spread throughout both continents and every region, so that it seems scarcely inferior to the native inhabitants. Was it not most perilous to draw so many tens of thousands of enemies upon oneself? But should it ever happen that they, acting in concert wherever they are, should come together in their own defense, an irresistible force would result, quite apart from the fact that those who inhabit Judea itself are countless in number, most noble in body, most bold in soul, and choose to die before their ancestral customs, out of a high-mindedness which some slanderers might call barbaric, but which, in truth, is the mark of a free and noble people. He was also frightened by the forces beyond the Euphrates, for he knew of Babylon and many of the other satrapies inhabited by Jews, not merely by hearsay but by experience. For every year sacred envoys are sent, bringing a great quantity of gold and silver to the temple, gathered from the first fruits, crossing roads that are hard to travel, untrodden, and endless, which they consider highways, because they seem to lead toward piety. He was, understandably, terrified that, on learning of the newly devised dedication, they might suddenly come upon him and surround him, some from this side and some from that, forming a circle, and joining hands might do terrible things to those caught in the middle. Reasoning in this way, he hesitated. But then again, he was pulled the other way by opposite considerations, saying, "This is the command of a master, and a young one, who judges advantageous whatever he wishes, and whose decision, once made, must be carried out, even if it is most unprofitable and full of contentiousness and arrogance. A man who has even leapt beyond humanity and already writes himself among the gods. Danger to my life hangs over me whether I oppose or yield, but if I yield, it comes with war, and is perhaps uncertain and not wholly bound to result. If I oppose, it is inescapable and assured, coming from Gaius himself." Many of the Romans who administered affairs in Syria, along with him, shared this opinion, knowing that Gaius's wrath and vengeance would fall on them first, as accomplices in the failure to carry out what was commanded. The making of the statue itself afforded him room for more careful deliberation. For it was not sent from Rome, by God's providence, I think, secretly extending a hand over those who were being wronged, nor did he order it transported by whichever of the artisans of Syria might be judged the best, since, given the speed of this lawless act, war would have flared up just as quickly. Having gained time for weighing what was advantageous, for sudden, great events, when they fall upon one all at once, crush the power of reasoning, he ordered that the making of the statue be carried out in one of the neighboring regions. So Petronius, summoning the most skillful craftsmen among the Phoenicians, gave them the material, and they worked at Sidon. He also summoned the leading men of the Jews, both priests and rulers, at once to disclose to them Gaius's orders, and also to advise them to bear what was being commanded by their master, and to keep the terrible consequences before their eyes. For the more warlike of the military forces in Syria stood ready, forces that would cover the whole land with corpses. For he thought that if he could first soften these men, he might through them instruct the rest of the multitude not to oppose. But he was, understandably, mistaken in his judgment. For they say that, struck by his very first words, they were instantly transfixed by the account of this unaccustomed evil, and struck speechless, poured out a flood of tears as if from springs all at once, tearing at their beards and the hair of their heads, and saying such things as this: "We who have been altogether fortunate have contributed much toward a good old age, only so that we might see what none of our ancestors ever saw. With what eyes? Our eyes will be torn out first, along with our wretched souls and our life of suffering, before we see such an evil, a sight not to be seen, which it is not lawful either to hear of unwillingly or even to conceive." Such were their lamentations. When those in the holy city and the rest of the country learned of what was afoot, as though at a single signal, the signal given by their shared suffering, they poured out all together, and leaving their cities, villages, and homes empty, rushed in a single surge toward Phoenicia, for Petronius happened to be there. Some of Petronius's men, seeing an unimaginable crowd bearing down, ran ahead to report it, so that he might be on guard, expecting an attack. But while they were still telling their story, and he was still unguarded, the multitude of the Jews suddenly settled over all Phoenicia like a cloud, striking terror into those who did not know the vast numbers of the nation. And at first, so great a cry went up, with weeping and beating of breasts, that the ears of those present could not take in its magnitude. For it did not stop when the criers stopped, but even when they fell silent, it went on echoing. Then came approaches and entreaties of the kind the occasion suggested, for their very misfortunes were teaching them what to do. They divided themselves into six ranks: old men, young men, boys, and again in their turn old women, women of age, and young girls. When Petronius came into view from a distance, all the ranks, as though under orders, fell to the ground, uttering a kind of mournful wailing together with supplications. When he urged them to rise and come nearer, they got up only with difficulty, and having poured much dust over themselves and streaming with tears, with both hands drawn back behind them in the manner of men bound at the elbows, they came forward. Then the council of elders stood and spoke as follows: "We are unarmed, yet some accuse us, on our arrival, of being enemies. The parts that nature has assigned to each of us for defense, our hands, we have turned back, where they can do nothing, offering our bodies as an easy target for the missiles of those who wish to kill us. We have brought with us our wives and children and whole families to you, and through you have thrown ourselves before Gaius, leaving no one behind at home, so that you may either save us all or destroy us all in one utter ruin. Petronius, we are peaceable both in our nature and in our deliberate choice, and our devotion to work, cultivated through the rearing of children, has trained us in this way of life from the beginning. When Gaius took up the imperial office, we were the very first of all the people of Syria to rejoice with him, at the time when Vitellius, from whom you received the governorship in succession, was residing in the city and received the letters concerning these matters. And it was from our city that the good news ran out to spread the report to the others. Was it our temple that first received the sacrifices offered for the rule of Gaius, only so that it should be the first, or even the only one, deprived of its ancestral form of worship? We give up our cities, we yield our houses and possessions, furniture, money, treasures, and all our other goods we will bring in willingly. We shall count this as receiving, not as giving. One thing alone we ask in place of everything else, that nothing new be introduced into the temple, but that it be kept as we received it from our grandfathers and ancestors. But if we do not persuade you, we surrender ourselves to destruction, so that we may not live to see an evil worse than death. We hear that infantry and cavalry forces have been made ready against us, in case we should resist the dedication of the statue. No one is so mad as to oppose his master while being his slave. We offer our throats readily and at once. Let them kill, let them sacrifice, let them cut us up limb by limb without a fight and without shedding of blood in battle. Let them do all that conquerors do. What need is there of an army? We ourselves will begin the sacrifice, fine priests that we are. We, the killers of our own wives, will present them to the temple. We, the killers of our own brothers, will present our brothers and sisters. We, the slayers of our children, will present our boys and girls, that innocent age. For tragic deeds need tragic names, for those who endure tragic misfortunes. Then, in the midst of it all, having bathed ourselves in the poison-like blood of our own kin, for such are the baths for those who are cleansed for Hades, we will mix our own blood with theirs, slaughtering ourselves last of all. Let the command be carried out once we are dead. Not even God could blame us, aiming as we do at both things at once, reverence toward the emperor, and loyal acceptance of our consecrated laws. And this will come about if we depart from a life not worth living, holding it in contempt. We have received a report, a very ancient one handed down by the learned men of Greece, who affirmed that the head of the Gorgon had such power that those who looked upon it were turned instantly to stone and rock. This seems to be the invention of a myth, but the truth of it is brought about by great, unwilling, and irremediable calamities. The wrath of a master brings about death, or something as bad as death. Do you imagine, may it never happen, that if any of our people, being led along, should see the statue set up in the temple, they would not be turned to stone, their joints fixed and their eyes fixed, so that they could not even move, the whole body's natural motions altered in each of its several parts that work together? We will make one last request, Petronius, the most just of all. We do not say that what has been commanded should not be done, but we beg and supplicate for a delay, so that we may choose an embassy and send it to meet with our master. Perhaps, having sent our embassy, we shall persuade him, either by setting out at length the matter of honor due to God, or the preservation of laws that must not be abolished, or by arguing that he should not treat us worse than even the nations at the ends of the earth, whose ancestral customs have been preserved. Customs which his grandfather and great-grandfather themselves recognized, setting their seal upon our practices with the utmost care. Perhaps, hearing these things, he will grow gentler. The resolutions of great men do not remain the same, and those made in anger are also the quickest to subside. We have been slandered. Allow the slanders to be cured. It is a hard thing to be condemned without a hearing. And if we fail to persuade him, is there then anything to stop you doing even now what you already intend? So long as we have not yet sent our embassy, will you cut off the better hopes of so many tens of thousands of people? Their zeal is not for gain but for piety. And yet we err in saying this, for what gain could be more profitable to human beings than holiness? They said all this in great distress and anguish, gasping heavily, their breath broken, streaming with sweat over every limb, with an unceasing flow of tears, so that those listening already shared their suffering, and Petronius too, for he was by nature kindly and gentle, was carried away by what was said and what he saw. For it seemed to him that what was said was entirely just, and that the suffering he witnessed was pitiable. Rising up, he deliberated with his council on what should be done, and saw that those who a little before had been utterly opposed were now wavering, and those who had been undecided were now leaning, in greater part, toward mercy. At this he was pleased, though he knew the nature of his superior, and how implacable his anger was. But he himself, it seems, had certain sparks of Jewish philosophy and piety as well, whether he had learned of it long before out of zeal for education, or ever since he had governed the regions in which Jews are present in great numbers in every city, both in Asia and Syria, or because his soul was by nature so disposed as to be self-taught, self-prompted, and self-instructed toward things worthy of study. To the good, God seems to whisper good resolutions, through which by benefiting others they are themselves benefited, and this is what happened to him too. What then were these resolutions? Not to press the matter, but to persuade the craftsmen well skilled to complete the statue, aiming as far as possible not to fall short of the renowned original models by taking too little time, since improvised work tends somehow to be cut short, while work done with effort and skill requires a longer length of time. Not to grant the embassy they had requested, for it would not be safe. Not to oppose the matter for those who wished to appeal to the ruler and master of all, to neither agree with nor deny the crowd's petition, for either course carried danger. To write to Gaius nothing that accused them, but not to conceal the truth of their supplications and entreaties either, and to attribute the delay in the dedication partly to the construction requiring a measured span of time, and partly to the occasion itself offering great and reasonable grounds for postponement. Grounds to which even Gaius himself would agree, not perhaps willingly, but of necessity. For the grain crop was at its peak, as were the other sown crops, and there was fear that men, driven to desperation over their ancestral customs and holding life itself in contempt, might either ravage the fields or set fire to the grain-bearing hill country and plain. And there was need of watchfulness for a more careful gathering in of the harvest, not only of the sown crops, but also of what the fruit-bearing trees provide. For he had determined, it was said, to sail to Alexandria in Egypt, but so great a ruler would not think it worth risking the open sea, both because of the dangers and because of the size of the escorting fleet required, and also for the care of his health, all of which are managed easily by one who makes the journey by land through the circuit of Asia and Syria. He had decided, so the story goes, to sail to Alexandria in Egypt, but so great a ruler could not think it fitting to trust himself to the open sea, both because of the dangers involved and because of the size of the escorting fleet, and also for the sake of his bodily comfort, considerations that are all easily satisfied by one who makes the circuit through Asia and Syria. For by that route he will be able each day both to sail and to put into shore, especially since he will bring along mostly warships rather than merchant vessels, for which coastal sailing is more practicable than sailing the open sea is for cargo ships. It was therefore necessary that fodder for the animals and abundant provisions be made ready in all the cities of Syria, and especially in those along the coast. For an enormous crowd would arrive both by land and by sea, setting out not only from Rome and Italy itself, but also following along from the provinces all the way to Syria, partly officials, partly the military, cavalry, infantry, the men of the fleet, and a household staff no smaller than the army. And what was needed was supplies proportioned not merely to what was necessary, but to the extravagant abundance that Gaius demands. If he should come upon this letter, perhaps, besides not taking offense, he will even commend our foresight, seeing that we made the delay not as a favor to the Jews, but for the sake of gathering in the harvest. When his council had approved the plan, he ordered the letters to be written and appointed men who traveled light and were accustomed to taking the shortest routes on their journeys to carry them. And when the couriers arrived, they delivered the letters, but he, while still reading, swelled with rage and was full of anger, making a note at every point. When he had finished, he clapped his hands together and said, Well done, Petronius. You have not learned how to listen to an emperor. Successive offices of command have puffed you up. Up to now, you seem not even to know Gaius by hearsay. Soon you will have direct experience of him. For you care about Jewish customs, a nation most hateful to me, but you disregard the commands of your ruler, the emperor. You feared the crowd, but were not the military forces present, forces which the eastern nations and their rulers, the Parthians, fear? No, you took pity. Was it then to pity rather than to Gaius that you yielded? Now you plead the harvest as your excuse, you who will soon receive, without excuse, the harvest upon your own head. You cite the gathering of the crops and the preparations for our arrival as your reason. But if total barrenness had gripped Judea, were not the neighboring regions, so numerous and so prosperous, sufficient to supply what was needed and to make good the deficiency of one land? But why do I raise my hands before the blow falls? Why should anyone perceive my intention in advance? Let the one who is about to reap the rewards of what he has done be the first to learn it from what he suffers. I stop speaking, but I will not stop thinking. And after pausing a little while over one of his secretaries dealing with the correspondence, he dictated his reply to Petronius, praising him for what appeared to be his foresight and careful consideration of the future. For he was extremely wary of provincial governors, seeing that they had at hand every opportunity for revolution, especially those in command of large armies in important posts, such as the forces stationed on the Euphrates in Syria. So then, tending to his rancor for a time with courteous words and phrases, he concealed it, though heavy with wrath beneath the surface. Then, at the end of everything, he wrote ordering that nothing be attended to so urgently as the swift erection of the statue. For by now, he said, the summer harvest, whether a plausible or a genuine excuse, could well have been gathered in. Not long afterward, King Agrippa arrived, as was his custom, to pay his respects to Gaius. He knew absolutely nothing of what Petronius had written, nor of what Gaius had said either earlier or later. Yet from Gaius's disordered movements and the disturbance in his eyes, he could infer a smoldering anger, and he searched and examined himself thoroughly, turning his thoughts to everything, small and great alike, to see whether he had done or said anything he should not have. But when he could find nothing whatsoever, he supposed, as was reasonable, that Gaius's bitterness was directed against someone else. Yet when again he saw him glancing at him askance and fixing his gaze on no one present but himself alone, he grew afraid, and though he often intended to ask what was wrong, he held back, reasoning as follows. Perhaps the threat, though aimed at others, I would draw upon myself, by giving the impression of meddlesome curiosity, of rashness, and of impudence. Seeing him then, agitated and at a loss, for Gaius was skilled at reading from a person's visible expression the hidden wish and feeling within, he said, "You are at a loss, Agrippa. I will put an end to your perplexity. After spending so much time in my company, have you failed to learn that I communicate each thing not by voice alone, but even more, or no less, by my eyes? Your fine and upright fellow citizens, the only people out of the whole human race who do not consider Gaius a god, now seem to me to be courting death itself in their obstinacy. When I ordered a statue of Zeus to be set up in their temple, they conspired as an entire people and left the city and the countryside, pretending it was to offer supplication, but in truth intending to act against my orders." As he was about to add more, Agrippa in his anguish kept changing color in every way at once, becoming flushed, then pale, then livid. Already a shudder had seized him from the crown of his head down to his feet. Trembling and convulsion churned every part and limb of his body. As his bodily strength slackened and gave way, he collapsed inwardly and in the end, going limp, very nearly fell, had not some of those standing by caught him. Ordered to do so, they carried him home on a litter, unconscious of anything, overcome by a stupor brought on by the sudden onset of these afflictions. Gaius, for his part, was roused to still greater harshness, intensifying his hatred for the nation. "If Agrippa," he said, "my closest companion and dearest friend, bound to me by so many benefits, is so overcome by their customs that he cannot even bear to hear about them, but from the shock very nearly died, what must one expect of the rest, who have no such counterweight of attachment pulling the other way?" Agrippa, for the first day and most of the second, lay oppressed by a deep stupor and provided no sign of life. But toward evening, he raised his head a little, and with heavy eyelids, opening them briefly and with difficulty, surveyed with dim and clouded sight those standing around him, still unable to make out clearly the features of each. Then, sinking back into sleep, he rested in a condition healthier than before, as far as one could judge from his breathing and the disposition of his body. Rising up again afterward, he asked, "Where am I now? Am I with Gaius? Is my master himself present?" When they answered, "Take heart, you are in your own house. Gaius is not here. You have rested well enough, having sunk into sleep, but turn yourself, raise yourself up, prop yourself on your elbow, and recognize those present. They are all your own people, of your friends, freedmen, and household servants, those who honor you most and are honored by you in return." He, for he was beginning to come to his senses, observed the sympathy each one showed. And when the doctors ordered most of those present to withdraw, so that through ointments and timely nourishment his frail body might be restored, he said, "Must you really take such careful thought for my regimen? Is it not enough for me, wretched as I am, to relieve my hunger through the plain and rigorously frugal use of necessities? Not even these would I have accepted, were it not for the sake of one last act of help, which my mind dreams of providing for my suffering nation." And he, in tears and eating only under compulsion, would not tolerate food without a relish, nor would he take even diluted wine, but tasting only water, said, "My wretched belly may for now hold off the debt it demands, but what is fitting for me to do but entreat Gaius concerning the?" And taking up a tablet, he wrote this letter: "A meeting with you face to face, my lord, fear and shame have taken from me, the one turning me aside from your threat, the other overwhelming me with awe at the greatness of your rank. But a letter will make known my petition, which I offer in place of a suppliant's branch. In every man, emperor, there is implanted by nature a love of his homeland and an acceptance of his own laws. And of this you have no need to be taught, since you cherish your own homeland with all your heart and honor with all your heart the things of your father. To each people its own customs appear excellent, even if this is not so in truth, for they judge them not so much by reasoning as by the passion of goodwill. I was born, as you know, a Jew. My homeland is Jerusalem, in which the holy temple of the Most High God stands. I was allotted grandfathers and ancestors who were kings, most of whom were called high priests, who ranked kingship second to the priesthood, holding that just as God surpasses men in excellence, so the high priesthood surpasses kingship. For the one is the service of God, the other the care of men. Allotted then to such a nation, and to such a homeland and temple, I make my petition on behalf of all three together. On behalf of the nation, that it may not carry away a reputation contrary to the truth, when from the beginning it has been most reverently and most devoutly disposed toward your whole house. For in whatever is granted and permitted to them, they practice piety according to their own laws. They fall short of no people, neither of Asia nor of Europe, at all in prayers, in the furnishing of dedicatory offerings, in the abundance of sacrifices, not only those offered at the public festivals, but also those performed continually day by day, by which they show their piety not with mouth and tongue so much as by the resolves of an unseen soul, men who do not merely say that they are lovers of Caesar, but truly are. Concerning the holy city, I must say what is fitting for me to say. As I said, this is my homeland, and it is the mother city not of one country, Judea, but of most countries, because of the colonies it has sent out at various times, to the neighboring lands, Egypt, Phoenicia, Syria in general, and the part called Celesyria in particular, and to lands settled far away, Pamphylia, Cilicia, and the greater part of Asia as far as Bithynia and the recesses of Pontus. And in the same way into Europe, Thessaly, Boeotia, Macedonia, Aetolia, Attica, Argos, Corinth, and the greatest and best parts of the Peloponnese. And not only are the mainlands full of Jewish colonies, but also the most highly regarded of the islands, Euboea, Cyprus, Crete. And I say nothing of the lands beyond the Euphrates, for all of them, apart from a small portion, Babylon and the other satrapies that possess fertile land round about, have Jews among their inhabitants. So that if my homeland receives a share of your goodwill, it is not one city but countless others that are benefited, established in every region of the inhabited world: the European, the Asian, the Libyan, those on the mainlands, those on the islands, those on the coast, and those inland. And it befits the greatness of your so great fortune, through benefits done to a single city, to benefit countless others at the same time, so that through every part of the inhabited world your renown may be sung, and praises joined with thanksgiving may resound together. You have deemed whole homelands of some of your friends worthy of Roman citizenship, and men who a short time before were slaves have become masters over others. And those over whom this has come to pass rejoice no less than those who have enjoyed the favor itself. And I, too, am one of those who know that I have a master and lord, yet who have been judged worthy of a place in the rank of your companions, inferior to few in standing, and second to none in goodwill, not to say first. Therefore, both because of my birth and because of the abundance of the benefits with which you have enriched me, I too might perhaps have taken courage to ask something for my homeland, if not Roman citizenship, then at least freedom or remission of tribute. Yet I have ventured to ask nothing of the kind, but rather the most bearable request of all, that you grant a favor which costs you nothing, and that my homeland receive the most profitable of gifts. For what greater good could come to subjects from the goodwill of their ruler than this? In Jerusalem first, Emperor, your longed-for accession was announced, and from the holy city the report went out to the mainlands on either side. And for this reason, too, it deserves to receive a privilege from you. For just as in families the eldest children obtain seniority of honor, because they were the first to give their parents the name of father and mother, in the same way, since this city was the first of the eastern cities to hail you as emperor, it is right that it should obtain a greater share of good things, or, failing that, at least an equal share. Having made these pleas and this petition on behalf of my homeland, I come at last to the petition concerning the temple. This temple, Gaius my lord, made by human hands, admitted from the beginning no image of any kind, because it is the dwelling place of the true God. For the works of painters and sculptors are likenesses of gods perceived by the senses, but to portray or fashion an image of the invisible God was not considered holy by our ancestors. Agrippa, your grandfather, honored the temple by coming to it, and Augustus honored it by commanding, in his letters, that first fruits be sent there from every place, and by the continual sacrifice offered on his behalf, and your great-grandmother honored it. Text lost here. For this reason no one, not Greek, not barbarian, not satrap, not king, not implacable enemy, not civil strife, not war, not capture of the city, not sack, nothing else that exists, ever introduced so great an innovation into the temple as to set up in it a statue, a carved image, or anything else made by hands. For even where people were hostile and hated the inhabitants of the country, still a certain reverence or fear kept them from abolishing any of the customs established from the beginning in honor of the Maker and Father of the universe. For they knew, from these and similar cases, the incurable disasters that spring from calamities sent by God. For this reason, they were cautious about sowing an impious seed, fearing that they might be forced to reap a harvest leading to utter destruction. But why should I call foreigners as witnesses, when I can bring forward many of those closest to you? Marcus Agrippa himself, your grandfather on your mother's side, when he was in Judea, at the time when Herod, my grandfather, was king of the country, thought it worth his while to go up from the coast to the mother city, which lies inland. And when he had seen the temple, and the adornment of the priests, and the sanctity of the rites of the people of the land, he was filled with wonder, believing that he had beheld something surpassingly majestic and greater than any account of it. And he had no other story to tell to the companions who were with him at the time than praise of the temple and of everything connected with it. Indeed, for as many days as he stayed in the city, out of regard for Herod, he went to the temple, delighting in the sight of its construction, of the sacrifices, of the ministry and order surrounding the sacred rites, and of the dignity of the high priest whenever he was arrayed in the sacred vestments and officiated at the holy rites. And after he had adorned the temple with as many dedicatory offerings as were permitted, and had done good to the inhabitants with gifts that would cause no harm, and had spoken much in praise of Herod and been praised by him in return countless times over, he was escorted all the way to the harbors, not by one city, but by the whole country, showered with leaves and admired for his piety. And what of your other grandfather, Tiberius Caesar? Does he not appear to have chosen the very same course? For in the 23 years during which he was emperor, he preserved the worship handed down at the temple from the most ancient times, abolishing or disturbing no part of it. I have, moreover, an instance of his scrupulousness to add, although I suffered countless wrongs from him while he lived. But the truth is dear, and it is precious to you as well. Pilate was one of the prefects appointed governor of Judea. He, not so much to honor Tiberius as to vex the populace, dedicated in Herod's palace in the holy city gilded shields, bearing no image and nothing else that was forbidden, except for a necessary inscription, which stated two things: the name of the one who dedicated them, and the name of him on whose behalf the dedication was made. But when the people at large learned of it, and the matter had already become the talk of the town, they put forward the king's four sons, who fell short of kings neither in rank nor in fortune, together with his other descendants and the officials among them, and begged that the innovation concerning the shields be set right, and that he not disturb the ancestral customs which had been kept inviolate through every age before, undisturbed by kings and emperors alike. But since he opposed them stubbornly, for he was inflexible by nature, and, along with his self-will, unyielding, they cried out, "Do not cause a rebellion, do not make war, do not overturn the peace. Dishonor of ancient laws is no honor to the emperor. Do not let Tiberius be your pretext for insulting our nation. He wishes none of our institutions to be overturned. If you claim otherwise, produce yourself either an edict or a letter or something of the kind, so that we may stop troubling you, choose envoys, and appeal to our master." This last point above all exasperated him, for he was terrified that if they really did send an embassy, they would also expose the rest of his administration. The bribes, the acts of insolence, the robberies, the outrages, the wanton abuses, the unjudged and repeated murders, the endless and most grievous cruelty, going through it all in detail. Being then such a resentful and heavy-wrathed man, he was in two minds. He had no courage to take down what had once been dedicated, yet he had no wish to do anything that would please his subjects, while at the same time he was well aware of Tiberius's firmness in such matters. Seeing this, and understanding that he regretted what he had done but did not want to seem to, the officials wrote most entreating letters to Tiberius. And he, on reading them, said such things to Pilate and made such threats. How angry he became, though he was not easily provoked to anger, it is superfluous to relate, since the matter itself gives voice to it. For at once, without even putting it off to the next day, he wrote back, reproaching and rebuking him at length for the newly ventured act of daring, and ordering him immediately to take down the shields and have them moved from the capital to Caesarea on the Sea, named Sebaste after his great-grandfather, so that they might be dedicated in the Sebasteum. And they were so dedicated. Thus both things were preserved, the honor of the emperor and the ancient custom concerning the city. At that time, then, there were shields on which no image had been painted, but now there is a colossal statue. And at that time the dedication was in the house of the procurators. But the one now expected, they say, is to take place in the innermost part of the sanctuary itself, in the very Holy of Holies, into which, once a year, the high priest enters on the day called the fast, only to burn incense, and to pray according to ancestral custom for an abundant supply of good things, prosperity, and peace for all mankind. And if anyone at all, I do not mean any of the other Jews, but even one of the priests, and not the lowest of them, but those who hold the rank immediately after the first, should enter along with him, either on his own or even together with him. Or rather, even if the high priest himself should go in on 2 days of the year, or even three or four times on the same day, he suffers inescapable death. So great is the guard that the lawgiver has set around the Holy of Holies, having willed that it alone, of all places, remain untrodden and untouched. How many deaths, then, do you suppose those consecrated to these rites would willingly undergo, if they should see the statue being brought in? For my part, I think they would slaughter whole generations, together with their very wives and children, and finally offer up themselves as a last sacrifice upon the fallen bodies of their own kin. These things Tiberius understood. And what of your great-grandfather, the best of all emperors who ever lived, the first to be named Augustus for his virtue and his fortune, who poured out peace everywhere over land and sea to the very ends of the world? Not learning by hearsay about the things concerning the sanctuary, that there is in it no image made by hand, a visible likeness of an invisible nature. He marveled and paid homage, having tasted philosophy, not with the mere tips of his lips, but having feasted on it more fully, and feasting on it almost every day, recalling in part from the memories of what his mind had learned beforehand about philosophy, and in part from his constant living together with learned men who were always at his side. For at his dinner gatherings, the greater part of the time was devoted to matters of education, so that not only the body but also the soul might be nourished with what belonged to it. Though I could confirm the will of Augustus, your great-grandfather, with abundant proofs, I will content myself with two. First, he wrote to the procurators of the provinces, on learning that the sacred first fruits were being neglected, instructing them to allow the Jews alone to assemble in their synagogues. For these gatherings, he said, were not drunken and disorderly assemblies got up so as to harm the peace, but schools of self-control and justice, of men who practiced virtue and who contributed their yearly first fruits, from which they offer sacrifices, sending sacred envoys to the temple in Jerusalem. Then he commanded that no one should stand in the way of the Jews, whether in assembling or in contributing money or in sending it according to ancestral custom to Jerusalem. For this, even if not in so many words, was at least commanded in effect. I have appended below, for your persuasion, my lord, a single letter, which Gaius Norbanus Flaccus wrote, making known what Caesar had written to him. The copy of the letter is as follows. Gaius Norbanus Flaccus, proconsul, to the magistrates of the Ephesians, greetings. Caesar has written to me that the Jews, wherever they may be, are accustomed by their own ancient custom to gather together and bring money, which they send to Jerusalem. These he did not wish to be prevented from doing. I have therefore written to you, that you may know that he commands this to be done accordingly. Is this not, O Emperor, clear proof of Caesar's policy, which he maintained regarding the honor of our sanctuary, in that he did not wish the common form applied to associations generally to abolish the gatherings of the Jews, which they hold for the sake of their first fruits and their other acts of piety? There is another proof, no less clear, of Augustus's intention. For he ordained that whole burnt offerings should be brought each day at his own expense to the Most High God, and these are still performed even now. The victims are two lambs and a bull, with which Caesar adorned the altar, knowing well that there is no image there, whether visible or hidden. But rather this great leader and philosopher, second to none, reasoned within himself that it is necessary, among the things of this earth, to set apart a special sacred place for the invisible God, containing no visible representation, for a share in good hopes and the enjoyment of perfect blessings. Having such a man as her guide in piety, your great-great-grandmother Julia Augusta also adorned the temple with golden bowls and libation vessels, and a great multitude of other most costly offerings. And why did even she do this, when there was no image within? For the minds of women are somehow weaker, unable to grasp anything beyond what is perceived by the senses. But she, just as she surpassed her whole sex in other respects, excelled in this as well, having risen above them by unmixed education, both by nature and by practice, her reasoning made masculine. So sharp-sighted had it become that it grasped things intelligible more than things perceptible, and considered even these latter to be but shadows of the former. Having then, my lord, such examples of a gentler policy, all most closely akin to you, from whom you were sown and sprang up and grew so great, preserve what each of them preserved. Emperors plead with an emperor on behalf of these laws, Augusti with an Augustus, grandfathers and ancestors with a descendant, many with one, all but saying, do not overturn, in accordance with our own wishes, the customs that have been preserved down to this very day. For even if nothing ill omen should result from their abolition, still the uncertainty of the future is not entirely free from fear, even for the most confident, unless they are contemptuous of divine things. If I were to recount the benefits I have received from you, the day would fail me, not to mention that it would not even be fitting to make a foremost matter a mere addendum to another speech. And yet, even if I keep silent, the facts themselves cry out and give voice. You released me from bondage in iron, who does not know it? But do not, O Emperor, bind me with harsher chains, for those who were released were bound only in a part of the body, but those now expected are of the soul, and are about to press upon it wholly, through and through. You banished the fear of death that always hung over me, and when I was already dead with dread, you rekindled me and raised me up as if by a new birth. Preserve this favor, O Emperor, so that your Agrippa may not depart from life, for I shall seem not to have been released for the sake of being saved, but rather, having received heavier misfortunes, to have died all the more conspicuously. You have granted me the greatest and most fortunate lot among men, kingship, first of one region, then also of another, greater one, joining to it what is called Trachonitis and Galilee. Do not, my Lord, having granted me the means for abundance, take away the necessities, nor, having led me up into the clearest light, throw me back from the beginning into the deepest darkness. I renounce those splendors. I do not refuse the fortune I had a little while ago. I would exchange everything for one thing alone, that our ancestral customs not be disturbed. For what account would there be of me, either among my own people or among all other men? Of necessity, one of two things must follow. Either I am judged a traitor to my own people, or I am no longer thought your friend in the same way. And what evil could be greater than either of these? For if I am still counted among the rank of your companions, I will bear the reputation of betrayal, should neither my homeland be kept unharmed from every evil, nor the temple be left untouched. For it is you great ones who preserve the interests of your companions and of those who take refuge in imperial protection. But if some hidden hostility toward me lurks in your mind, do not imprison me as Tiberius did, but rather, having removed even the hope of ever being released again, order that I be put out of the way at once. For what good is life to me, when my one hope of safety was your goodwill? Having written this and sealed it, he sent it to Gaius, and shutting himself up at home, he remained there, in anguish and turmoil, worrying above all how it would be received. For no small danger had been thrown at him, but one involving destruction, enslavement, and utter devastation, not only for those who inhabit the sacred land, but for the Jews everywhere in the inhabited world. Gaius, taking the letter and reading it through, at each thought at once knew that his wish would not be carried out, and at the same time was moved by the pleas mixed with justifications. And he praised Agrippa in one respect, but blamed him in another. He found fault with him for his excessive devotion to his own people, who alone among men resisted and turned away from his deification. But he praised him for concealing and hiding nothing of himself, which he said were signs of the most noble and freeborn character. So, softened as far as it seemed by these more gracious responses, he deemed Agrippa worthy of the highest and greatest gift, granting that the dedication should no longer take place. And he ordered that it be written to Publius Petronius, the governor of Syria, that he should no longer make any innovation regarding the temple of the Jews. Yet even in giving this favor, he did not give it unmixed, but blended into it a most grievous fear. For he added in writing, "But if in the districts bordering the metropolis, outside it alone, some people wish to set up altars or shrines or certain images or statues in my honor and that of my family, and are prevented from doing so, those who hinder them are either to be punished on the spot or brought before me." This was nothing other than the beginning of factions and civil wars, and a crooked way of taking back, in effect, the gift he seemed to be giving outright. For some, out of rivalry against the Jews rather than out of piety toward Gaius, were bound to fill the whole land with dedicatory offerings, while others, seeing in their own villages the dissolution of their ancestral customs, even if they were the gentlest of all people, would not tolerate it. And Gaius, judging those who were provoked worthy of the greatest punishment, would order the statue to be set up again in the temple. But by some providence and care of God, who watches over all things and governs with justice, none of the neighboring peoples stirred up any trouble, so that no occasion arose by which, ahead of a milder complaint, an inescapable calamity was bound to be met. But what good was that, one might say? For even while they remained quiet, Gaius did not remain quiet, already repenting of the favor and rekindling the desire he had felt a little before. For he ordered that another statue be made, a colossal one, of bronze overlaid with gold, in Rome, no longer moving the one in Sidon, so that he might not disturb the populace by its movement, but that it might be carried secretly and at great leisure by ship, while remaining undisturbed and free of suspicion, and be set up suddenly, unnoticed by the crowd. This he intended to do on his voyage along the coast during his journey to Egypt.